Oh,
What's up?
are you so excited for this drink?
Yeah,
I'm
maybe.
excited.
I don't know. It smells good.
Haven't actually assembled mine yet, so
I mean, it's not that hard.
yeah. Well,
But I will say I did do my cardinal rule, which is that I didn't have lime, but I had lime seltzer. So we're gonna see what that train looks like.
it's lime seltzer, Coca-Cola, and tequila.
And salt, apparently.
And salt. I know I put salt in mine, which
Stirred with a knife, as the guy said.
I
So,
appreciated that part.
hey guys, welcome to Theology on the Rocks. We're back.
We're back again.
Christy decided she had other
You
friends.
know what? It's not all the time. Oh shit, I just spilled. Sorry, now I'm
What was
cussing.
that? What was that, ma'am?
Just spilled tequila on my laptop.
Oh no.
It's okay. It was
Well,
not.
it is it though? I don't
It
know.
is. It was not a, like a vital part, and it was only a drop. So
Just on like the left keys, which who
it's
uses those
just
anyway?
the M key. So who spells anything with the letter M?
Not me. Not E. Yeah, so you last week had a friend in town and y'all went to Disney World.
We did. We went to Epcot.
Oh, sorry.
Well, it's Disney
It's
World.
all just,
It's
I
the
just
same.
it's all yeah.
You're still right. But we went to Epcot because she was like, "Well, you don't like rides because I don't like roller coasters."
Like at
So she was
all, or are you
like,
just like against, are you scared of them, or do they just make you feel barfy, or both?
all of it. The whole experience is terrible,
Okay.
in my estimation. But she likes roller coasters. So she was like, I didn't want to go to Magic Kingdom and want to ride the rides, and you wouldn't ride the rides. Well, I don't know when the last time you were at Magic Kingdom was, but those roller coasters are not designed to be like scary in any way, shape, or form.
I think that's where the, is that where the Star Wars thing is? Because I was just there.
No,
So
the
I
Star
don't know.
Wars one is at Hollywood,
Okay, well, that's okay. Yeah.
which again, also, there's one roller coaster. It's the Hollywood one that I did because my friend Aaron made me. And the picture that Disney took, you know, like there's a place where they take your picture,
Yep.
is
How'd it go? Glamour shot.
it is pretty hilarious.
So that means you have to put it on the internet now.
If I can find it, I will put it up because I look like my soul has come out of my body.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
Anyway, I do the rides at Magic Kingdom is the point of that story. So I told her
But you
next
say
time.
that they're not even really rides, so
It's mostly like getting a
is it like the teacups?
teacup or a form of a vehicle and then like enjoy a weird animatronics version of the movie. Like, I love the rides at Disney because I can do them all because I'm not, except
I will
for
tell
like
you
Splash
talk
Mountain, where
about
I can do that.
being scared on a ride. You put my ass on the teacups, all bets
Not
are
like
off.
the
All bets are off.
t
Like,
this is the weird thing is I hate roller coasters with a fiery passion. I love the teacups.
the ones that spin you around, are
Yes.
you
I
crazy?
know, it's amazing. They're so much fun. I would
They
do
make me feel like I am going to barf, get a migraine, and maybe cuss out a child all at the same time. Like,
I will do the teacups all day, every day. I love them so. I love
I can't
spinning.
believe you don't like the roller coaster, but you'll spin yourself into
I'll
non-existence.
spin myself right out of this world, but no, never. I don't
So
like
it's just the
falling.
heights, I
It's
guess,
the
but
heights. It's the height and it's the falling sensation. I'm just really not a fan of it. So.
isn't it funny that we decided that that's what's going to be amusement? Is we're like, the thing that
Come close
we,
to death.
Well, that's it. The thing that we spend all of our life trying to avoid. They're like, come do it. And oh, by the way, just trust us. We've got this.
Trust that you're not gonna get flung off.
So you spend, like, I've now spent 41, well, I'm not gonna count the baby years, but like some odd amount of years trying to keep myself from dying. And then they're just, I'm just supposed to trust.
I know. This is what I don't understand.
Who I don't know.
I don't understand about people who enjoy roller coasters. Although
well, we get on airplanes, which is kind of the same concept. I mean,
but I have to take medicine for that. I will remind us both of the time we rode a Ferris wheel in Carolina. Oh, gosh.
I can't believe you did that. So for my birthday, we went to Carolina Beach, which is a beach. And most of us got on this Ferris wheel because it seemed okay.
It did. At the start, it seemed okay. And it's not one of the two-person ones where you're, like, just staring into your death. It's one of the, like, bucket ones, you know, which I usually do a better with, but.
She and I gripped the center pole on because I, like, here's what I don't mind roller coasters. I can do them, but whatever is happening needs to happen fast. And the thing, so like I don't have to think too much about it because mine is like the buildup.
Yeah.
So like when we went to that place at Disney, they had the drop thing. What was it? Tower of Terror.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not doing that because it's the exact opposite. Because they're like, not fast. Yeah.
You're like, maybe this time, but maybe no.
This time we're gonna fall. Yeah. And I'm like, no, I just need to go up and fall. That's what needs to happen. So, but come to find out, despite it being slow, a Ferris wheel is terrible because it also goes. It you just think about it.
You're just up high, and it's
like,
and then it
a
just
long
stops there. You're just
time.
Hanging out up there, and they made us go around so many times,
which most people would be really happy about.
We were not. We were like begging them to let us off.
We would go around, and the guy was like, yay, like, you get to go around again. Because
we'd be like, no.
There. And Christy and I were like, let us up.
And your friends are, like, cracking up the whole time.
They were so uncomfortable. Even our friend Susie, who's in a group chat with us, was just like, I don't get it. Like, what's happening right now?
Why are you two absolutely dying? Yeah, I don't like heights. That's been my lifelong issue with everything people think is fun. I'm like, I don't want to be up here.
I bungee jumped in Panama City Beach, Florida once after I got my belly button pierced.
Oh my God.
And I know. I was not, I will not say how old I was. So, but I went up there, and this is in the day where I did have a little bit of like a streak of like I'm invincible because you know you're a teenager, but I did tell the guy, I said, you're gonna have to push me, but I'm not gonna be mad at you. and he goes, well, I can't do that. I said, no,
I legally cannot push you.
But I said, no, hear me out though, my guy. I was like, I'll get like real close to the edge, but like even if you blow on me aggressively, like that will be fine.
You just need to make me actually go over.
So he just came behind me, and then I just bent my knees and just like did the saddest little like fall over. It was like, you know how people like do the jump where they like spread their arms out,
yeah,
and they're like, ah, just imagine the fetus version of that.
So there's Mindy Kaling wrote a book, she's written several now, but her first like memoir book, and in the beginning of this she describes a scenario when she was a child when she climbed to the top of a like diving thing at a lake and thought that she could just climb back down, and they were like, no, you have to jump. And she says that she just kind of fell instead of jumping.
Yeah.
And the way I'm not going to do this justice, so just saying, go look this up. But the way she describes her body just kind of like limply falling off.
That's exactly what mine was.
Is how I'm like picturing you.
Yeah. No, it was, I got up and I had done a very common like redneck activity is to go quarry jumping is what we call it, uh-huh. which is deeply unsafe, kids, so don't do it. But like it's basically where you jump, like there's a lot of quarries that fill with water. Some of them are water like holders. You see a famous one in Atlanta that's in like a bunch of movies. Anyway,
isn't this how that a kid died in one of those like teenage rom-coms in the beginning, Remember or something?
I'm sure a lot of them did. Oh, the one with Reese Witherspoon, Man in the Moon, is it?
I don't know. I just remember the kids going and well, it was in the beginning of the movie that I don't remember. So.
Oh, maybe it's not that one. But yeah, no, it's incredibly dangerous, partially because, well, one, it's incredibly high. But also you don't know what's going on underneath.
Yeah.
So you could be like, anyway, we did it often. And so, and I did it once and, it was so funny because I was, actually quite older at this stage. I was off my parents' insurance. So I was 26 or something. And I know, right. We were in Atlanta and I did it. And my friend Sarah was climbing back up because that's another thing that they don't tell you is you got to get back up to where you started.
Yeah.
Because that's usually where like your cars are. And when I did, I stepped on a rock that broke and I fell in the water and I thought, oh, like that sucks. I got to start all over again. I looked down and I have sliced. Okay. Gross alert, y'all. If you don't like it, fast forward. I sliced my foot like in on the side where it was like flapping on either side.
Oh no. Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. So then me and my friend Anna, who that day, by the way, is the twin of Sarah, had gotten in a car wreck, who also wasn't on the insurance. We went to Walmart. She had a black eye and like scratches on her face. And I had a flapping foot where I was hobbling while it was bleeding through multiple socks, where we were in Walmart just getting Band-Aids.
No hospital.
We had no money. We couldn't have done it.
That, but you could have lost your foot.
Where I say this as a 40-year-old
who's like...
Where was I supposed to? Actually, my mom's a nurse who works at a hospital. So the answer, but I didn't want, but here's the key.
You don't want them to know.
You didn't want them to know.
Yep, so the options
are very slim. So I swear she and I rocked up to this Walmart in Georgia with like, just like bandages. It was like some mummy costume that we were assembling. And the woman looked at us and I kid you not, she had a black eye and scratches and I had blood all over my shirt from my foot. And she just was like, how y'all doing?
That woman is mentally taking pictures of you guys. I'm thinking when the police come later, I'll be able to scribe them so well.
It was just such an advertisement for universal health care.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So to this day, I will show you. I have a gigantic scar on my foot from that event. And
hey. Cheers. Have you had this yet?
Guys, we're doing the badonga. I know that's
I don't know what it's called. I put it on the Instagram.
The way he says it, he has a real emphasis on the front, like a batanga.
Batanga, yeah.
This was given to us by our friend and my former colleague, Helen.
Helen, from saver Scotland. Of lives, best of friends.
Mover of offices for me multiple times in my early academic years when I had no effing clue what I was doing with my life.
I'm gonna say this and I mean it with the most seriousness that you could possibly say it. The only reason that I managed to get through my entire PhD on like an administrative level is Helen.
Helen is an administrator at University of Glasgow. Go ahead.
She saved I got like administratively withdrawn at one point for some reason. I can't remember why. And like she would go in and
being
fix
a
it,
jerk.
Like put me back in this. I mean, she kept me in that program for ages. So thank you. Cheers to Helen.
Cheers to Helen. Helen, who became my friend because she said I did what she asked me to do.
Yes.
Which feels at a job a very basic level thing. Welcome to academics. Cheers, yep. Helen.
Yep. Cheers. Oh, it's good.
I'm not sure.
I don't know that I put enough tequila.
I'm not sure I put enough Coke. We're on different ends of the spectrum.
Like, I'm only tasting Coke, really.
I'm only tasting tequila. And the salt. I may have went a little southern on the salt situation.
I feel really like I need to put more tequila in here, which... it feels like also a bad idea, but
you should.
I'm gonna do it
because I want you to be where I am. And what happens is that the Coke loses any cokeness.
The Coke loses cokeness.
It doesn't taste. I didn't think there was anything that could de-sweeten a Coke,
but it's tequila
to this level. Like the Coke feels like it's just a neutral vehicle at this stage, which I never thought Coke would be.
I'm also going to put more salt in here.
I mean, why not? Then you're just going into Margaritaville if you do that. But, I mean, that's fine also.
Okay.
All right.
Let's see. Is this better? Oh, my goodness.
I think you shouldn't be allowed to have alcohol today.
You know what else I did today, which I'm most mad about?
Did you drink this before you tell me the story?
I did. It's better. I can taste slightly more tequila. It's not just like I'm drinking a Coke.
Okay.
Well, I like it. I'm a fan.
I'm not sure yet.
Well,
I don't. It doesn't.
I still mostly taste. I don't know what you're doing wrong. Maybe my tequila is just not very
strong. I did a double shot.
I mean, I technically now have 3 shots in this sucker. So
here's the deal. I did use my fancy tequila.
You did.
Like, not fancy, but like my, you know how you get about me having the gin that I have?
Yeah. You have good tequila.
I have good tequila.
Really have good tequila, but it's fine. It's not what I would have bought in college.
The problem with good tequila, which I think is maybe unique among the spirits, is the better it gets, the less you taste it. Which is a bad thing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I'm just sitting here being like, oh, it just tastes like I'm drinking liquid. That's where the danger comes in.
Well, let's see how it goes when I'm at the bottom of this and if I'm like just falling off this couch. I decided, because I just moved and I have to find a Chinese food place. So I was like, I'm going to go get Chinese food for dinner before the podcast. And a couple of weeks ago, I ordered Chinese food off of the apps, whatever. I don't remember which one. And it was honestly really bad. And I don't know that I've had really bad Chinese food in a long time. Like
since Scotland.
Since Scotland. I mean, here in the US, how do you mess up Chinese food, really? Well, I can tell you the place because I accidentally got food from there again tonight.
Did you?
Because
you go in person.
And this time I went in person, so it just did not click until I got home and I was like putting it onto a plate and I was looking at it and I was like, oh no. And sure enough, it's the worst Chinese food I've ever had in my life. And now
you've had it again. Right. Was it just as bad this time?
Yep. It was even maybe worse, honestly. It's really truly horrible. So
oh no.
I'm very sad about it.
Well, here is my food story of the day. And I hinted at this in the group chat. I have had difficulty understanding my husband recently about life things. And I don't know. I've been living with him now for like a decade. And there's just some things that miss the mark because usually we're like right on with each other.
Yeah.
So he made a casserole, and all of my cats are pretty good about like not being on the counters except for one. I'll let you guess which one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Beethoven, who is a psychotic terrorist. So we made a casserole, and then Stuart needed to go do something. And I said, okay, well, we're going to need to put that up because he will straight up shove his face into it. We came in from to a scene where we had just taken stuff out for Thanksgiving. I went to the bathroom, Christy, for number one, and I came back. And it looked like a zombie had attacked these rolls that were in a bag. It was carnage.
Oh, my God.
And it's just him sitting there, and then he just walks away. He doesn't even care. So I said, you know, we need to put this casserole up. So I'm sitting on the couch, and he goes, yeah, like, okay, I went ahead and put it in the fridge. But this was several minutes down the line. And I said, okay. I said, Stuart, I said, you can't put a cat in a fridge. But there was no joking. I legit thought, because the last thing I had said was Beethoven will get the food. And then he said, I put it in the fridge. And I jerked my head around. And I said, sir, you can't put the cat in the fridge. And he said, for a moment, Leah, you thought about it. Because I could see you, like, kind of think about it. And then you just went into, like, moral crusader mode. And he said, what are you talking about? And then he said, I put the casserole in the fridge, not the cat. And I went, oh, that makes so much more sense.
And you were...
I was stone cold sober.
Maybe you should put Beethoven in the fridge.
There was a moment where I thought, would he die? He's very furry. The fridge is pretty low, like, but not that. It's not the freezer. He didn't put him in the freezer. And it was only going to be for like 2 to 3 minutes. So there was, I love that everyone's going to be calling PETA right now.
I know.
But it's just so funny because I did have a moment where I was like, no, you can't.
That's amazing.
He looked at me like I was nuts, and I was for a moment. Like, but yeah. He laughed because he said the only reason that you thought that I did it was because you had thought about doing it.
You were like, I understand. This is tracking for a minute. Yeah. Yep.
So that was the story about Beethoven.
I love that so much.
I know. Hey, guys, don't put your cats in fridges.
Don't put your cat in the freezer or in the fridge.
Or the freezer. But
don't put your cat in cold places.
I have a constant, like, fear that the cats are in they're obsessed with the washer dryer. And I think it's probably from, like, horror movies of past.
I mean, honestly, this is a thing I hear from a lot of people because cats really want to go in them, and it's really dangerous because if you don't check,
they drown or they fry themselves.
Yeah, like either way, it ends terribly.
I know, and I have this vision where when stuff started, they would just be, not that they're ever quiet ever, but that this would be the time when they decided to get quiet.
Yeah,
like. They'd just be like, oh, like, this is fine that my body is, like, rotating and warming up. Like, I'm not upset about it at all. I'm not going to scream, you know.
This wouldn't happen with Penny because of who she is. But my last dog, Lizzie, was the kind who would, like, sneak into rooms and you wouldn't necessarily know it. She was always hiding in places. So she wasn't ever going to make a sound. She got locked in rooms and in closets many times, and I would be like running around the house calling her name, and she would just sit there quiet as a mouse until I happened to open the correct door. Drove me nuts. I was like, Salem or something.
Right, just accept this
fate. But that's where I was like, I would have been just so nervous about Lizzie hopping in there, because she would have just hopped in there and then been quiet and then died.
Oh, no.
I know.
Well, guys, sorry to depress you on so many levels. But we are back again. Welcome to Theology on the Rocks. And today we're talking about, it is Black History Month.
It is Black History Month.
And so we're talking about
Black theology.
Yeah. Oneness theology. And so I was thinking about this as I was running on the treadmill, as you do, when you're trying not to think about how bad your decision making was to get on the treadmill, is that I was thinking, I typically have written about the civil rights movement and done history of religion in the U.S. So that's kind of my sort of strong point in terms of Black theology. And I'm guessing yours is more in the kind of systematic realm of that.
Kind of. So I've done mostly in terms of Black theology, James Cone. But also womanism is really where I've found myself being mostly. And with that, Katie Geneva Cannon, who is probably top three favorite theologians for me, like across the board.
Well, now you have to tell the other two.
I'd have to think about it.
Okay. I like that you're like, she's top three. I'm not sure who the other ones are.
I'm like, I have a commitment issue, so I don't want to say it first just in case later something pops into my head. But like,
watch out, Penny. you might be in that dryer before you sleep.
But she does what the same kind of thing that I do, only slightly differently. She did literature and theology. So a little bit of the mixture between systematics and the interdisciplinary. But yeah, I mostly did work with womanism in my book and in a lot of my research.
In your book.
Yay! In my book, which just got its edits all done. So it's moving forward.
Meanwhile, I'm writing my third book and I hate it. So
I mean, I never want to look at my book again.
You don't have to.
The nice copy editor lady was like, "Do you want to look it through one more time?" And I was like, "Absolutely not. Thank you. No. It's fine." But yeah, so that's what I mostly work on. Which,
yeah,
obviously, like some of that also intersects with the civil rights movement and stuff. But
I was thinking maybe I could start with like a little bit of the history and then. Maybe we can just have a conversation.
I think that is the best plan. Yeah.
So people always post stuff about Black History Month and everything. But one of the things that I do during that time is I try to find a new Black theologian that I've not heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of look into their stuff a little bit.
Yeah.
And so this is going to fit in a little bit with the history because I found a woman.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, like in my classes, at least when I teach, so I historically have taught religion in American history. And of course, I talk about first indigenous peoples and their religious stuff, which is very diverse, but some of the common characteristics that exist. And then I talk about the slave religions that were brought over, but also how they mixed with, or, you know, didn't, with the Christian religions of the slave owners, essentially, aka colonists, but I mean, slave owners too. I'm not saying they all were, but there was a lot of them that were.
There was a lot of them.
Yeah. And one of the things that you come across with those early days is either and the slaves have, again, this very broad, not at all nuanced category of African traditional religions, which is really that with indigenous religions is oftentimes just a catch-all for that group, which is crazy to me. But you know, there are some shared stuff. But anyway, so what happened when the slaves were forcibly removed from their country and kidnapped and brought to the U.S. Is there was kind of a full-on rejection. That's one option. Like, so the slaves practiced, they may have on the surface practiced Christianity, but they were basically just, you know, performing, and they practiced,
so they didn't get killed.
That's right. That's right. Because apparently slave owners had a moral code, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Right. And then the second was they accepted Christianity kind of just, they just did. They just accepted it. Yeah. And we can talk about that in a minute. And then the other one was that they mixed Christianity with their own African traditional religions. Yes. And that's where you start to get some of like the hoodoo and voodoo stuff yep. that comes out, which is a mixture, a Santeria and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, yeah. So in those early days, that's kind of, but the focus with a lot of Black theology is kind of that group that accepted it, which kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. And what they did with it. And this is a question I have for you. And I always ask my students, this is in those beginnings, isn't it amazing that people, or I'm sorry.
Oh God. Penny, come here. There was a noise. Hey. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
No, this is the question. What do you think it was that drew the slaves to the religion of their oppressors, essentially?
It's a thing that I think about often because it's one of the sections in my world religions class that I'm teaching. The first kind of, hey, stop it. Literally, humans existing is very upsetting to her.
I mean, same with Zero, but his bark would make us all think we're dying. He's got a very German Shepherd bark.
we do indigenous religions, which again, you cannot do like properly in a week, but we just basically look at two as kind of examples, and one of them is Yoruba, which is a West African indigenous religion from Nigeria primarily. And the survival of Yoruba, and then it ends up like growing considerably. So it's actually quite a large religion at this point today. But like looking at it and talking about like why it survived. And again, as you mentioned earlier, the way that it kind of combines with, especially with Catholicism, to help kind of birth voodoo and especially Caribbean or Haitian voodoo. It's like, okay, so let's look at the reasons why this is helpful. And I think it's fascinating to see the kind of obvious similarities between Yoruba and Christianity. In this idea of like there's an all-powerful absolute God, and then there are other beings who are helpful, which Yoruba talks about as like lower being or lower gods, but Christianity kind of uses as like angels or saints or and so it would have been easy for the enslaved people to pretend to be Christian. But the longer you're doing that, the more that kind of stuff is going to seep in too, you know?
Yeah. Everyone gets so freaked out whenever I say, do you want to go to the voodoo? There's a voodoo museum in New Orleans, and they go in and there's like all these Catholic saints. And
yeah, I'm like, cause they were like, these basically work for what we thought were those lower gods.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a really interesting thing to think about, like people, especially people who are in horrible situations like that, are obviously going to turn to the things that give them some amount of hope or strength, or at the very least, like, I'm going to die, but here's the comfort I'm clinging to, you know? Yeah. And to see how closely related the two religions are anyway, I think it makes a lot of sense that many of them were like, okay, this one works too. Like, this is what they're practicing, and not to belittle their conversions. I don't think it was like just a convenience factor, but it's not like you're asking them to convert from, you know, Hinduism to Christianity.
Right.
A wildly different religion.
And the hope factor, I think, is, you know, because I teach that there was like the official churches. So like the slave owners would have them go to official separate churches, but they would use a lot of these churches would use something called the Jefferson Bible. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's it basically is a edited
Yes.
Bible that takes out passages. And I always say, what would this, in my class, I'm like, what would the slave owners not want the slaves to see?
Yeah.
And they're always pretty good about being like, Exodus? And I'm like, So it just took out a lot of the stuff that was like about freedom. And of course, a lot of Jesus's teachings. But then as the years pass and they get their hands on the actual, you know, text that has not been edited, you know, these underground churches start to emerge. You know, I can see how they would be converted, because all of a sudden, you know, God's chosen people are enslaved.
Yeah.
And God saves them.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I think this too is like Judaism and its concern with people being in exile and being enslaved or being oppressed, and how God cares for them and helps them out of that and all of that is obviously very appealing.
Yeah,
you know,
100%. And I mean, and not, this is going to be a word we use a lot, liberating.
Liberate, yes.
But yeah, so those sort of early days of the slave churches and it becoming a place, you started to get preachers and all of this and everything done in secret. And it was just, it was amazing how they thrived. And having been to a contemporary Black church, you know, people always talk about the differences and how, you know, segregated Sundays are and everything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a different feeling when you go to this. It's like you're back there in some ways. Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of joy and freedom and preaching on freedom and that kind of stuff that you can see that it is a unique sort of aspect of the Black church.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, it's, I think it brings over still a lot of the cultural, because again, if you look at like how religious ceremonies are performed in Africa too, there's, you can see a lot of that cultural stuff, obviously different, but the roots of it are still there, you know?
Yeah.
And too, I think this also kind of comes back to the fact that the very earliest church moved into Northern Africa before it moved up to Europe. And you know, there were quite a few of those early Christians, and like Coptic Christians still exist, which is an extremely old denomination of Christianity. All of it in Africa. So I think we have a tendency to think that like Africa wasn't exposed to Christianity until the missionaries started going in whatever year the missionaries started going.
Well, that was kind of
whatever that happened. But
depends
like,
on, it depends on, you know, one man's missionary is another man's you know, colonizer.
Yeah. Well, and exactly. It's like the missionaries and the colonizers are coming on the same boat.
That's right. I mean, and I think that's something too that became that when my students are oftentimes shocked is that they use theology to justify slavery, which, you know, is interesting, because then the slaves flip the script on that. So the slave owners would say, you know, well, I mean, there was a variety of things they said, hashtag bad theology, guys.
Yep.
that, you know, oh, well, they'll never know Jesus, which again, based on what you just said, is probably not correct, because
you know, like they've had Christianity longer than Europe, you know.
Right.
I can't remember when I or where I saw this, but there's a conversation going on about like, oh, well, when the missionaries brought Christianity to Ethiopia, and they're like, we already had it, like it was there before you guys got it, you know. So
yeah, there's some quote that I can't remember, but it was like God was already here.
Yeah,
they say they brought God, but God was already
Was already here.
Yeah,
all they were really bringing was European culture and and then stealing people, kidnapping them.
Yeah, 100%.
So well, and then I think too, you know, that understanding that makes it like clear that the kind of Christianity that would have been being practiced during slavery would have been really like very much more similar to, again, the kind of Jewish theology, very like prophet oriented kind of stuff. So they're talking about very different themes and theology. So then when you get into the civil rights movement, they already had a lot of that developed.
Yeah, because that was James Cone's thing is like, prophets, Exodus prophets and Jesus. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The sort of, those are the things that tend, because those were the liberating elements. But I need to tell you before we get into civil rights group, two things. One is there's a great documentary by Rich Hall, who is a Southern comedian, operates mostly in the UK. But he did a documentary called The Dirty South, and it's on YouTube.
Okay.
And you can watch it. And it talks about religion and how, religion was kind of, in some ways, well, the main focus is the South and like how the South has been portrayed in media and all of this stuff, to where there is this caricature. Some of it is true and some of it, you know, da 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 is a little over the top. But he does focus on that kind of early the slave churches and how Christianity deeply influenced the South, because a lot of times people think of religion in the South, they think white evangelicalism, but actually the Black church deeply important to things like, you know, rock and roll and you know, music, and but also this idea of that the civil rights movement wouldn't have existed without the church. So he is very firm in saying every movement, every law that got passed, every protest that occurred, they organized in the churches. The churches were the center, and that's why the people tried to blow up the churches. The white people, assholes, basically, because that's where they went to organize.
Yeah.
And so, I think it's really interesting that the church became not only this place of hope in the early days that they could have for themselves, but also became this headquarters for freedom as the years continued to progress. Yeah. So that's one. But the two is my theologian.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get this up because I took a screenshot. So Octavia Albert. Have you heard of Octavia Albert? I had not.
I have not. Tell me more.
So, I need my glasses, Christy.
Leah got reading glasses and it's changed her life, and they're very cute.
Thank you. She sees me on pillow when I'm pulling her and I'm like, nope, I'll take them off. And then I'm like, this world sucks. I'm not doing that. So basically, this is what drew me to this person, is that, so this is in the Reconstruction era. So basically this is post Civil War. The South has been basically obliterated, and people are the slaves are free unless you're in Texas, and they're free in Texas, they just don't know yet, but a lot of people of color flee, former slaves flee to like the North, Chicago, oftentimes that area, but then some stay, you know, and actually a lot of
a lot stay,
because that's their home. And so this is during the Reconstruction era. Octavia Albert is in Louisiana, so she decides to stay, and her house actually becomes this place where she sits with people and she talks with people, and she's basically an oral historian, and she takes their history and she talks with them not only about their history, but she's deeply, deeply religious. So she talks to them about Christianity, and so this is a quote from her. She says, and she writes, I should say, she writes this book called The House of Bondage.
Okay.
And it's published in the 1890s, and it's out of copyright, and I'll put this up on the website. So you can actually read it on the internet. I was reading parts of it, and it's amazing. So she's getting all these stories and so much theology. It's so rich in theology. But basically she was just inviting people over and saying, talk to me about this. So she says, this is a quote: "When I pause and think over the harsh punishments of the slaves by the whites, many of whom profess to be Christians, I am filled with amazement. We know we have passed from death unto life, because we love the brethren, in parentheses, the white people.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, and it says Albert, this is not a quote, it says Albert didn't have a title in the academy or the church, but like many women in our congregation, she bleeds Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from Nana Dulce. Ooh, fun last name, Dulce.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was my person. And so I was started to read her stuff that was online, and it's just, I love storytelling. I think it's a part of being
yeah.
upfront, but she does it so well. And just the faith of the people who were watching these self-professed Christians just mm-hmm. be absolute monsters
yeah.
to the human race. And then to continue to keep the faith is just,
that's fantastic. I really yeah. like, I'm going to go look that up for sure. Cause I think that one of the things that draws me to like Katie Cannon and also just generally to literature and theology is the idea of hearing people's theology through their stories rather than, you know, as we know, systematics can be a bit dry.
What?
Time to time.
Christy,
you know,
that's rude.
It's a shock that I would say such a horrible thing. But
that disembodied theology could be a bit dry. Tell me more. Okay, continue on my rant.
You know, to look at stories of people or stories that people are telling and understand how they're viewing God and the world in general through those stories, I think it's very impactful, and it's more clear what's going on with, especially in these kinds of situations. You know, they can't sit down and write church dogmatics, you know, for a multitude of reasons. They mostly just, they don't have time to do that, you know? And so instead we get stories, and there's teachings through stories and teachings through, you know, rituals and things like that. And then like later we have this breadth of amazing Black theologians, but they're not the first time, like James Cone is not the first Black theologian, you know?
No, no.
And
I think too, it's one of these things that based on what you just said, what if we did take some of these like church dogmatics and take it as theology in a context, which I say all theology. And then all of a sudden, like the work of Octavia, it becomes systematics, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's legit.
Because, I mean, as much as you say all theology is practical theology, I also think that all theology is systematic theology. It's just how we organize our systematics looks different, you know? It's being written in a different way, but there's still all of that same stuff. It still has the same intelligence and all that. We just get snotty about things, but,
You dropped out there when you said all theology. I didn't hear anything after that.
Oh, all theology is
just kidding.
Is all theology is also contextual theology.
I'm joking.
You can't understand Bart outside of his context.
Oh, 100%.
You have to know what he is speaking to. You can't understand anybody.
You gotta know about that person that was living in the house, right? And that lady, right?
Yeah. But like, this is what I really appreciate about what Cannon does in her work, because she was like very focused on her teaching as well, and so a lot of her efforts were to make theology very teachable and something that she could not just put in a book but take into a classroom. And so she works through literature, mostly Zora Neale Hurston, and talking about the experiences as kind of a collective, like this is the experience that Black women have, we can see in these stories, you know, and then what do we get from that theology? She does it really well. Also, she, in one of her books, goes through a pretty significant section on chattel slavery and what would have happened to all of those people and the kind of horror, and talks a lot about hope and stuff like that. And so by going through these stories and talking about these stories, I think, you know, developing not just what kinds of things we should do now, but understanding like why the church has always been such an integral part of the culture, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that's where I'm sort of moving, not at all comparing, but as theology is storytelling, I think is kind of where I'm moving with my writing. And it's, I think it's interesting to, cause it's more human, you know, you're getting the human aspect as opposed to, and in some ways, I guess it's, I may be being a little too harsh. Maybe that's what the Barts and the Bonhoeffer, well, no, Bonhoeffer was doing it, but like the Paul Tillichs and all of that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what they were doing, you know, like,
I mean, to be fair,
we're telling their own stories, and we just, much like a lot of stuff in canon, we decided, oh, well, this is the highest form of knowledge about God.
Yeah. I mean, I do, I think we do that so often. I tell my students this when we study Shakespeare. It's like Shakespeare was not Shakespeare when he was writing. He was right. getting paid for stuff. They were like, here, write a play about this king. And he was like, okay, I will. And then I'm going to insert stuff you may not pick up on to make it my own. The Sistine Chapel was commissioned. Like, they were all making money on these things. And then we are like, look at this inspired thing. Isn't it amazing? You know?
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily coming from the same kind of place of like genuine truth when it's those kinds of things that we tend to canonize. But that's just because they were popular and paid for.
And this is that's Christie's high church that was just speaking there. But my my low church would say also that it could still be inspired, but that's not really for us to, we can discern it, but we can't know it.
I think it could be still inspired. I mean, like, for sure, I like some of Shakespeare, not all of it. I like.
What's your least favorite Shakespeare?
My least favorite Shakespeare? God, probably Hamlet, honestly.
Ooh, dang, girl. Heavy hitter.
I hate it so much. I was more a fan of his comedies, but like,
I feel like Kevin Taylor, if he's listening, just died. Kevin, again. Like, you're talking about Kevin's Thomas, like, Hardy. God,
this woman should not have a degree in literature.
Thomas Hardy all over again.
Thomas Hardy all over. You know what? I take it back, because Hamlet at least is mildly interesting, but like the history ones are awful. Like all the ones about Richard, I never read those. I took a class in undergrad on Shakespeare, and it was the histories and tragedies, and we had to read all of them. So like, let me tell you, I've done it. I've been there. I've suffered, as many have suffered before me, but
doing the Lord's work. Good job.
But like, when I was sitting in the Sistine Chapel staring at that ceiling, was I moved? Of course I was. It's gorgeous. You know, like, I'm not like trying to take away from those things and saying like they're not amazing, but the reasons that they get lauded as canon or as the pinnacle of their art form are almost always just because they were popular and paid for, you know? So you put...
I tried to take a picture of the Sistine Chapel.
Did you? I was too afraid, because I'm kind of a good intuition.
They really
don't want you to.
About it.
Yeah.
And I messed it up because, well, I didn't mess it up. I didn't have a flash because it was old school. And so it just came out black. And I was like, you know what, Leah, that you deserve that.
That's the other, honestly, that's the other thing. I didn't have a cell phone because it was long enough ago that I had a cell phone, but it wouldn't have worked in Europe. And so I just had like a point and shoot camera. There was no way I was going to be able to take a picture without everyone knowing what was happening. So.
I was also like 23. I was a dumbass and whatever.
But like, if you hold that up to, you know, Chinese art was like 100+ years ahead of European stuff at the same time, you know, like their technology was massively ahead of us. So like, why do we say these things and not those things again?
What's when I talk liberation theology, and the thing that, if you guys are studying theology, one thing you'll notice is that Latin American feminist, queer, black theology, et cetera, et cetera, are considered, quote, contextual theologies. Yeah. And that is such an annoying thing for me.
It's exactly this, is why are they contextual and Bart isn't?
100%.
You have to read Bart in context, you know? It should be.
Like, there's theology, and then there's what y'all are doing in your own little world. And it's like, and you can't, you're only talking to your people, which if we go back to the Black theology is not true at all, because there's something to be said.
Yeah.
You know, when James Cone said, what did he say? Was it God is Black or Jesus is Black? One of the two. And people lost their minds.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were like, no, he's, well, they, all the white people were like, in our church,
no, he's
very
Scandinavian.
White. Scandinavian. Right. He's, well, he's Palestinian, whatever. Like, you know, that's,
yeah.
But they didn't take the time to kind of think about what he was saying, which is that, mm-hmm. you know, God created the, you know, people who were in slavery, and that God clearly has a deep, deep connection. And these stories that we get from the Exodus show that God's chosen people were also enslaved. So, you know, there is this connection.
Yeah.
And this feeling that, you know, God knows what that's like and embodies that.
Yeah. Jesus even says, like, when you're interacting with poor and oppressed, you're interacting with Jesus. He doesn't say, when you're interacting with King so-and-so, that's me.
Right.
You know, like, we need to be more thoughtful about how Jesus wanted us to understand these things too. And keep in mind too, that I think, and this is my question for you, is what, because people do tend to say things like Black theology is for Black people, or mm-hmm. Something like that. And like, if you read it, like, that's lovely, but it's not really for you.
Yep.
So what do you as a white person get out of reading Black theology?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so I would say a lot of who I am, and I joke about Krista being from Colorado, but a lot of who I am as a person is because of where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And it affected a lot of, so like when I went to school, I remember I saw Black kids getting beat up,
mm-hmm.
being called terrible names,
mm-hmm.
Stuff you can't hardly imagine. And then me going into a classroom, and we had elocution teachers that would come in and say that we wouldn't go to college if we sounded the way that we sounded.
Mm-hmm.
And then just being a woman, just generally.
Yeah.
And so when I read some of the stuff from, I would say especially, I did read King for my peace building stuff and my civil rights stuff, and Malcolm X as well.
Yeah.
And I think I felt really interested in that dynamic, because at the time I was supposed to be writing about peace building, but I was angry.
Yeah.
And I was righteously angry. I was doing stuff in Northern Ireland. I was wrestling with being a woman theologian, mm-hmm. and all of this stuff. And I listened to some of the back and forth between Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, and how they pitted them against each other, which is just another thing that pisses me off.
Yeah.
And as I was listening to them talk, they both had this activism that was based on theology, that was different, but it was inspiring in its own way. And so I think with me looking at growing up where I did and feeling not in any way oppressed in the way that African-Americans feel in America, and I'm not claiming that, but there were moments where I felt incredibly less than.
Yeah.
And there were moments where I thought, oh, I want to bridge the gap between those who think I'm less than for gender, geography, whatever.
Yeah.
And then there were times where I thought, I want to fight this system and watch it burn to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciated those two folks, because on any given day, and it was so interesting because I read something, actually James Cone, I think, did the biography on those two. And he writes, he says, they actually kind of evened out at the end.
They did, yeah.
Like, they became more, like, King got upset because things weren't happening fast enough, because mm-hmm. Malcolm X thought King was putting Black people up to the slaughter, basically, by the nonviolent stuff. And King thought Malcolm X was being too extreme in his mm-hmm. views. Of wanting change and wanting it fast. But by the end, they'd kind of met in the middle.
They had, yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that's sort of where I'm at the minute. And then another aspect I think would be womanist theology, and womanist theology is essentially women, African American women,
yeah,
doing Black theology and saying, "Hey, you haven't spoken to us." And I appreciated that because I saw a lot of, I remember reading Mary Daly and these feminist theologians for the first time and thinking, oh my gosh, like, this is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beyond God the Father. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And so that feeling of being included in the conversation, how wonderful is that?
Yeah.
You know, and again, growing up where I did, women couldn't. In the Dalmatian, women couldn't be ministers. They couldn't speak in. They couldn't do this. And the idea that God was the Father, always He, and all this sort of stuff. And that she writes, beyond God the Father. And so when the womanist, when I started reading womanist theology, and I was like, yes,
yeah,
they're included in this conversation.
Yeah.
Like, and so while I couldn't feel what they felt, I felt that I had experienced an experience that was somewhat similar in the inclusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my answer. A little bit of social activism.
Yep.
Hot-headedness, as we've talked about before, versus calming my ass down. And then also like being included in the conversation,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I think that's great. I like it. I think, and this is where when I look back on my first encounters with Black theology and James Cone specifically, I read Malcolm X's biography? I can't remember.
Well, there's one that's about the both of them that I really think James Cone wrote it,
but I think it's just about Malcolm X. Now I can't remember
if
he wrote it or if it's a biography. This is like a normal thing to know. It's just left my brain because of my 3 shots of tequila, which by the way, I can very much taste the tequila at this point.
I know. You like my, like, when I just start using emotion words instead of describing things, that's when you know the tequila has said.
We're down at the bottom. I'm like, oh, this is so beautiful. I love it. but I read it in high school, and I remember being like, that man sounds really angry. And I felt the same way about James Cone. So, like, my first thing is that I feel like I have to always preface this with, like, my first encounters with Black theology were not, I was not listening. Like, I put it on myself. It was nothing that, but I was not listening. I did not have good opinions of it. I was like, this is too extreme. And honestly, a lot of it had to do with, I think, a feeling of not liking that I was the bad guy in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And getting defensive about it, because I had a few Black friends when I was growing up, but I grew up in very white spaces, so there weren't a lot of Black people. And the people that I was friends with that were Black were probably code switching a ton, and like, again, in retrospect, I feel terrible about that, but I honestly didn't know about code switching to begin with. I didn't realize like how uncomfortable it must have been for them in these places. Like, there were 4 Black kids in my high school class.
What?
Like, what? My class was only 100 students, but I think there were only 4. It was, like I said, really, really white,
Was this in Colorado or
Ohio? No, this was in Ohio.
Okay.
This is when I was in Akron. Kate, don't bark again. I'm having a serious conversation. Come here.
She's raging against all the oppression.
She's like, what?
She's like, don't take me back to Ohio, Mom.
Ohio is terrible. No, I was in Akron, Ohio, which is not an especially white place, but I was at a private school. Stop it. Nope. Anyway, and then,
like, our
and then I went to college in Greeley, Colorado, which is super white.
I know.
I didn't know, and I wasn't around. Again, this is all kind of excuses, but so my first encounters were not great. But then I came back to it years later, and I was reading through Cone, and I was like, I totally misread all of this the first time, and B, like, I think Black theology has a sense of hope that is terribly missing from a lot of the like systematic theology that you read.
Mm.
And maybe because of what we've been talking about, but I don't know, there you get a lot, especially with like the Reformed theology, of like God is punishing us for things, or you know, don't do X, Y, or Z, worry about losing your salvation, all this kind of stuff where it's like, I just have to live in this kind of state of fear in my life. And Black theology is so beautiful in its sense of like, God is for us and God relates to us. God's suffered with us, all of that kind of stuff. And I was like, this is so much more accurate. This is understanding God in the world rather than being like, you have to be perfect to really relate to God. And that kind of sense of perfection was really hard for me to get over for a long time. And so I was able to both kind of recognize the ways that I had failed to listen to Black people for a long time, but also to be like, honestly, this is saving my faith in a lot of ways, because it's not that kind of doom and gloom, fire and brimstone stuff that you get from so many Calvinists. And again, still a small percentage Calvinists. So, you know, there's
still hanging on.
But yeah, it's just not, it's not so deeply depressing. Well, even if it's talking about depressing stuff, there's a sense of hope that is so important.
Yeah. And if your life is, you know, whether it's Civil War, Reconstruction, Civil Rights, or 2024, like there's still oppression happening, and you have to have a, you have to have a sense of hope in the midst of this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what drew the OG Black theologians, even if they called that, and what continues to. And I think, you know, I grew up a little bit I was still in North Georgia, but it was a little more diverse than that. And then moved to Atlanta, and it was just, you know, living in Atlanta, going to seminary, you couldn't really escape at all Black theology. It was, you know, I lived across the street, literally, from the Martin Luther King Memorial.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I would go study at his grave, which has a little fountain around it. But I think with that, it can make you a little bit, and I played basketball growing up, so a bit, there was a lot of people of color on my team. But like, I think in a way it can make you, the opposite of that is it can make you a bit lazy and complacent, because you're like, oh, well, you know, I knew my best friend was, you know, a Latina woman and remains a best friend, you know, so I don't have to deal with, you know, or, you know, of course I played basketball, so of course I'm not racist or whatever.
Right.
And it, you kind of miss, you know, I went to Atlanta to a Baptist seminary where all these civil rights people who walked with King taught me theology, you know, and it's like, so I don't have to dig too deep into my own stuff. And I think, so, instead of sort of being scared of it, I just sort of got lazy in it,
I think,
in some ways. And so when I revisited some of the stuff, I was like, wow, I wasn't really engaging in that in the way that I should, taking it to the level that I should. Like, and I think, and really examining my own self. And another thing about growing up Southern is, unless you're just a right-wing, you know, person who lives, or a person who's very sheltered, you kind of grow up knowing that you're part of the problem. It really gets driven home a lot, to the point that we get a little sensitive about it, I think. That you're like,
think
the dumb redneck that talks funny, that hates Black people. And I think for that reason, you know, it can, that wasn't me growing up. I was very lucky with my parents who were not like that at all. But those kind of folks, I could see them being, when people vote certain ways in the South and people mm-hmm. can't believe they voted, you know, they want to ban this book on the civil rights. Well, you know, if you get taught that you're the bad guy from when you're young, you know, I mean, and I'm not saying it's right and I'm not saying it's what I think, but yeah. I can see those people and I can.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. It's like, in retrospect, I'm so grateful for the people in my life who were putting these things in my path, even when I wasn't reacting well to them at the time, because they stuck with me, you know, and kind of in the reverse, if you're raised in Colorado, you're part of the, like, we weren't even a state during the Civil War. So like, it's not our fault.
Look, don't try to get out of this. You're in this with me. Georgia was totally blameless. What are you talking about?
Well, you know, it's like, we were like somehow kind of told we were the good guys. You know, the South was the problem. The North was not. We're not either, but we don't get to be the problem. You know, like,
I know
there was a very, it's those white people were the problem, but I'm a good white person.
And I just,
and I had black friends.
And I'm like, I wish I could tell you how to, not that I'm like the Southern translator, but like, I wish I could just go to them and whisper in their ear and be like, look, guys, this is what you need to do.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the thing is, like, again, I had black friends. So there was just a lot of the way I was growing up thinking like, I'm fine. And then I read these books and they were like, here are the problems with white people. And I was like, how dare you? Like, mm-hmm. I'm the good one. So, but again, that kind of confrontation was important for me to have, you know? And like, it took me a bit to get to a place where I was willing to listen, but eventually I did. And now I can be more aware of the ways that I have been racist in my life and the kinds of things that I, you know, made probably uncomfortable for some of my black friends because I didn't take into consideration their experiences or anything like that. Cause I was just like, oh, we're all friends. It's fine. You know?
Yeah. I mean, so, and that was I think how we still participate, which I think is something that the theologians talk about. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, I go to this super liberal Christian church here in Charlotte. That's multicultural-ish, yeah. I would yeah. say. But then, you know, you start talking to, when we were buying a house, real estate agents. Mm-hmm. You want to get a real interesting view on how racism still exists.
Yeah.
Oh, talk yeah. to your local real estate agent.
Yep. Yep.
And it was so interesting because later I felt like Stuart, who's from the UK, maybe the whitest place on the face of the planet.
Truly, truly the whitest.
And from Scotland, sorry.
Again, you've heard now how many people I got to Scotland and I was like, where are the black people?
My mother said that when she went to Scotland. She looked around, she was like, everyone's white. Like, she was like, was flabbergasted.
It's the whitest white, and it's also somehow like more shockingly white because they're so pale.
They're so pale. But yeah, so you still, like, I would sort of have to do a little bit of a translation sometimes. I'm like, well, this is what that person meant when they uh-huh. said this about the real estate. And I was like, and afterwards I thought about it, I was like, oh god, we're still doing this, you uh-huh. know, still. It's still happening. I'm talking about education and all that sort of stuff. Like, these schools are the good, you know, like, yep. it's just, mm-hmm. bleh. It's yep. a lot. And so I think it's something that, you know, a lot of people are like, well, we don't need this sort of theology anymore because we've gone this far.
We haven't.
And it's like,
haven't.
No,
yeah.
we absolutely haven't. And, you know, that's the same for queer theology, feminist theology, yep. et cetera, et cetera. Like, we're not, it's forever.
It's forever. It's yeah.
forever.
Until we stop calling all of these theologies by an adjective, there or we start saying like German theology, you know, white man theology. I don't know what to call it.
white theology. There's a chapter in a book that I will find that's called white theology.
White yeah. theology. Mm-hmm. But like, yep. until we, it's one or the other. You still have to keep doing this. And I think
shout out to Pete Enns. I have a shirt that before I had met Pete Enns, he does the Bible for normal people. Mm-hmm. And I have a shirt that says all theology has an adjective.
Yes, which is exactly true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's so important for us to keep in mind, like, how we allow those theologies to speak to us, even if they aren't giving us direct things, right? Like, one of the other things I feel like I keep trying to do is to make sure that I'm reading stuff, not just because I'm like, oh, I need them to edify my life in some way, mm-hmm. but like just so that I can learn from somebody who's different from me, mm-hmm. and to keep diversifying all of that. So like, it's not necessarily helpful for me to learn about like, you know, the ways that indigenous religions in Korea have mixed with Christianity, but it's still good for me to learn about it, you know?
Yeah. And like my mom said something, I won't say what it was, but it was like Christmas. And like I said, my parents have been they were sort of my saving grace in the midst of the South.
Yeah.
Like, because they have their own stuff, but ultimately they were this sort of, they had their head right
on the shoulders. Yeah.
And, but I remember she said something at Christmas, and it was to her revolutionary, to me, common knowledge.
Yeah.
And it wasn't her being dumb. It was a social thing.
Yeah.
And she had just, you could tell she had just accepted that this was real for her. And I said, Mom, you know what? That's awesome. I said, be a little gentle with yourself. That's okay. It's okay to be gentle with yourself.
Yeah.
Because here's the deal. Like, and it's not about everything. Because there are those moments where people need to either shut the up or stop doing things, quit killing people, quit, you know, shooting people or whatever. And then there's sometimes when you get this light on.
Mm-hmm.
And when especially some of the older generation get that light on, there's a moment I think that we can take. Because we're all social justice workers. We want things to change so fast.
Yeah.
But to just give them space to sit in it.
Yeah.
For a minute. And to be, you know, because it's a bigger deal in some ways for them. Because they didn't have this.
Yeah.
And if they did, they weren't reading it.
Yep.
They weren't. I mean, my Cohn was writing during, you know, my parents were a bit young for the civil rights movement, but they still had the aftermath, you know. But anyway, I think, and again, this is not excusing people to be assholes. That's not what I'm saying.
All. But it is saying, like, we all, I mean, if you want people to learn, you have to give them the space to learn. You can't just yell at them all the time, you know.
I think I learned that from Northern Ireland, is like,
yeah,
with the Protestants and Catholics. It's like, you got to let them have space to make small steps. And it's frustrating as ever loving hell. But
because you're like, why don't you know this already? But if you are, I mean, just think about literally any small child learning something. If you were like, how did you not know that already? Like, they're encountering something for the first time and you're mad at them about it.
Maybe they didn't seek it out.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're at the end, guys. Thanks. the tequila is definitely talking at this stage. But I did want you to say the book, this is not a hard one, the book that you think was the most influential either in womanist or Black theology as we exit that you would recommend.
Katie's Canon. This is an easy one for me. Read Katie's Canon. It's great. It's a collection of essays, or all by her. And
we'll put this on the Instagram along with the book by Octavia that I mentioned earlier.
And some other books I think that have kind of like helped me along the way, we'll put them all up, but Katie's Canon is my favorite. It's like I said, it's a bunch of essays, and she wrote it because her students said that this was like the stuff that they learned the most from, so she put the collection together like in dedication to her students, which is super sweet. But yeah, it's a fantastic look at a lot of the stuff we've talked about. She goes through again chattel slavery stuff and Zora Neale Hurston, and then civil rights and all of that. She talks a bit about MLK as well in there. So what about you?
The Cross and Lynching Tree.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. It's one that I don't necessarily think it's like the best of the best for everybody.
It's kind of like a foundational text.
Okay, then it is the best of the best.
Well, I mean, like, you know, it's like you have to start there.
Yeah, it was, I also read, is it Thurman Allgood?
Marshall?
The Thurman Marshall, that's right. So I read that for my PhD, but I will say, I think the Lynching Tree book, it just hit me. One, because of, again, just the title.
Yeah.
And what it, that's by James Cone, by the way, guys. Yes. And also this idea of, because I didn't really get when he was making these statements, like, you know, because I hadn't yet got into like queer God and disabled God and that, mm-hmm. you know, folks had written about. And I didn't understand when he said about, you know, Jesus is black or God is black or whatever. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite get what was being said.
Yeah.
And reading that and reading about the suffering and the suffering of African-American people, mm-hmm. and slaves, and how God shares in that suffering. And as a result, there's that connection.
Yeah.
Just to me, like, really solidified the understanding of, you know, when then I read Nancy Eisland, The Disabled God, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
It was foundational in that sense of like, oh, the queer God. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Marcella, no, I mean, I get it. Yeah.
Cause well, obviously he's not the first black theologian. He is like really kind of important starting point when you're talking about black theology specifically. And that book is important too. So.
Yeah. So that would be mine.
Good. Both solid, but yeah, we'll put up some theology recommendations. Yeah.
Kelly Brown Douglas. I don't know if we mentioned.
Oh yeah. Kelly Brown Douglas. Is fabulous. M. Sean Copeland is also great.
Yeah. We'll put up some, well, you're going to get a Instagram stories overload.
You are.
It's and fun. Now I'm going to go talk to my husband about, yeah. about what I say, normal life. I mean, non-theology life. Putting my cats in freezers. We're going to watch Love is Blind, probably.
Same. And oh, I'm so excited.
It's in Charlotte. Yay.
It is a drama fest. That's well, for sure.
I am ready. And so it's going to be hard. It's always hard when we do our podcast and we've been drinking. And then I have to go talk to him. And I want to be like, fight the power. Yes. He usually has just gotten off work and he's like,
I just want to decompress. And you're like, we have to start listening to Public Enemy immediately.
He's like, why did I do this? You knew what you were getting into, sir.
He loves it. All right. Well, we'll be back next week with something totally different.
Yeah. I have an idea.
Okay, good.
All right.
Bye. Bye.